reports warns of the imminent threat of racially motivated violence by extremist white supremacists in the U.S. Iran repeats its demand that the U.S. sanctions should be removed for the revival of the JCPOA. Also ahead, nearly 200 more unmarked graves are discovered near a former church-run indigenous residential school in Canada. World News, we're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, a U.S. Homeland Security report has warned about the possibility of domestic extremist attacks ahead of the summer season. The report says violent extremists might seek to take advantage of easing COVID-19 restrictions and more access to public gatherings to conduct attacks. It added that critical infrastructure and police officers might also be targeted. The report also expressed concern over the rise in mass shootings in America. It said the upcoming 4th of July celebrations and other anniversaries are typically associated with high-profile racially or ethnically driven attacks. John Kiriakou is a former CIA counterterrorism officer joining us out of Washington, D.C. John, welcome. What's your take on this report by the Department of Homeland Security?
I think that they wouldn't have released a report like this had they not believed that it was serious. And I think it even goes beyond what they have warned us about. I think that Donald Trump's insistence that he won the election and that the election was stolen from him and that he is somehow magically going to become president again in August is forcing a lot of people to consider taking up arms in their view to protect their liberty, to protect the Constitution, to fight for Donald Trump. And, you know, where we've always had these white supremacist groups or illegal militias, I think this adds another layer. And it's something that the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and even state bureaus of investigation are very worried about.
These threats of potential violence, John, can they be contained? Because FBI reports in the past, multiple FBI reports say that white supremacists have infiltrated into law enforcement departments.
Yes. There was an incident just a year ago where the entire police force of a small town in Virginia, it was 30 police officers, all had to resign. The entire force had to resign because they were photographed giving the Nazi Hitler salute. We have evidence that white supremacists have infiltrated local police departments. They've infiltrated the military. We saw that really turn violent on January the 6th. So this is something that the FBI ought to be worried about. It's something that's been going on for a long time and no one did anything to stop it.
Right. So, I mean, when you have this infiltration into the security forces, including those that are supposed to protect Americans domestically and, you know, from international threats, do you think Washington has a successful strategy or any strategy at all to deal with this?
If we compare what happened on January the 6th, the answer is no. There is no successful strategy. I think what everybody is the most afraid of is that this is going to come to actual violence. That, well, on January the 6th, the police did not fire, with one exception, they did not fire their weapons, and they were beaten. One died. Two committed suicide afterwards. I think that the police, if there's going to be an uprising from the right, are going to have to be prepared to fire at those people, at the very least, to protect themselves.
John, thank you very much indeed for
my
your
pleasure.
dots there, and contribution John Kiriakou there, former CIA counterterrorism officer, joining us out of Washington, D.C. Now, Iran's ambassador to the UN says the U.S. must remove all sanctions it has imposed on the country in a verifiable manner if it wants to see the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal.
Given years of serious violations of JCPOA by other sides, it is essential to secure enough assurances that all sanctions are removed verifiably, and the U.S. will not, once again, withdraw from the JCPOA or abuse its mechanism to create another implementation crisis to deprive Iran of its benefits from the deal.
Addressing a Security Council meeting, Majid Takhtaravanchi said these measures are vital for building confidence and continued adherence of the U.S. and the EU to their commitments. Takhtaravanchi said this will create a calm, stable atmosphere for economic and trade contacts and cooperation, allowing Iran to fully reap benefits of the deal. He noted that those who broke their promises must make hard decisions and not Iran. The meeting was held to discuss the UN chief's biannual report on the implementation of Resolution 2231 that endorsed the nuclear deal. The Yemeni army says it has launched a missile attack against sensitive military targets in the country's Ma'rib city. The army said it used ballistic missiles to hit those targets. It said dozens of Saudi-backed forces, including several military commanders, were killed or wounded. The Yemeni army dismissed allegations that its operations in Ma'rib target civilians and residential areas. Ma'rib has witnessed fighting between the Yemeni army and forces loyal to the Saudi-backed former regime in the past several months. Members of the Ansar Allah movement are also helping the army in its operations to retake Ma'rib. The city is the last stronghold of the former regime loyalists.
The crisis in Yemen is deepening as fresh fierce clashes between Yemeni forces and Saudi-led militants have erupted in Ma'rib. The clashes happened between Yemeni forces and Allied Popular Committees fighters and the rival forces who are loyal to former President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi. Local sources say the Yemeni troops and Allied Popular Committee fighters mounted intensive attacks from the north, south, and west to push the Saudi mercenaries out of the region. Saudi warplanes are reported to have conducted more than a dozen strikes on residential areas across the region.
Well, it clearly shows that the Ansarullah movement cannot be defeated. And that's what's so important, that Saudi Arabia, with all of its vast military equipment and years of U.S. support, military aid, jet aircraft, naval blockades, have failed to defeat the Ansarullah movement. And as a matter of fact, have suffered one defeat after another.
Over the past few weeks, Ma'rib has been the scene of large-scale operations by Yemeni troops and their allied forces. They are pushing against Saudi-sponsored pro-Hadi militants. Yemeni forces are closing in on Ma'rib, the last stronghold of pro-Hadi forces in northern Yemen. The loss of the strategic region would mean the defeat of the Saudi-backed regime. Yemeni forces had earlier liberated several strategic heights in the northwest of the province after intense fighting. Analysts believe control of the oil-rich region of Ma'rib would strengthen the bargaining position of Yemeni forces and peace talks. The fierce clashes come amid fresh attempts to bring an end to what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Analysts believe Saudi Arabia is desperate to find a face-saving way out of its disastrous bombing campaign in Yemen. It is believed that the Saudi regime has failed miserably in Yemen, as its foreign interventions have failed to produce desirable results for the kingdom.
Clearly, it shows that Saudi Arabia could not prevail through military measures. So now they are talking about, let's have a peace agreement. But they're asking for many things that they could not win on the battlefield. So whether they will gain it in peace talks, that's highly unlikely.
And when it comes to peace talks, the National Salvation Government has outright rejected the Saudi peace offer. It accuses Riyadh of refusing to open the airport and give unhindered access to Hodeidah port, which is the main entry point for most of food imports to Yemen. The West, however, accuses Ansar Allah, not Saudi Arabia, of sabotaging the peace talks.
The new administration in Washington has pushed for fresh attempts to bring the war to an end, but Yemeni forces have dismissed the so-called peace initiatives presented by the U.S. to end the war in the country, saying such plans are not favorable since they fail to include the Yemeni nation's demands, including lifting the siege on the port city of Aden.
The UN is acting in favor of major powers and exhibits clear bias. The aggressor countries are committing the most heinous crimes against Yemeni children, and yet they were not included in the list. The UN decision is disconnected from realities and does not rely on independent accounts.
Any peace agreement must be based on ending the siege, the closing of the ports, and the distribution of food to the population of Yemen, who've been held hostage by Saudi Arabia and also by the U.S. through this whole process.
Ansarullah Movement says no just solution to the humanitarian crisis in Yemen has been worked out yet. The Yemenis say the aggressors have to end all their attacks against Yemen, take out all their forces, end an all-out siege that they have been imposing on the Arab country, including the port city of Aden, and compensate the victims before entering any peace process.
Well, they certainly have no desirable result. They first announced that this would be a war over in a matter of weeks and then months, and it has dragged on for more than 6 years. So it's a complete disaster in the eyes of the entire region. It does show the weakness of this corrupt regime that is unable to carry on a war against a country far less technologically, doesn't have the means, doesn't have the military forces, and yet it has a mobilization of the people. And that is what is decisive again and again, as we're finding in every country.
Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies have been engaged in a devastating war in the country that began in March 2015. They were backed by the U.S. and other Western powers. The aggressors were trying to reinstall Yemen's former president, Abd Rabbah Mansour Hadi, a staunch ally of Riyadh, to crush the Ansarullah Movement. The Saudi war has failed to achieve its goals, but pushed Yemen to the brink of a humanitarian crisis. Saudi officials claimed that the war would last only a few weeks.
Turning to other news now, in Canada, another 182 unmarked graves have been discovered at a third Indigenous residential school, the latest in a series of findings that have caused outrage across the country. The remains of pupils aged 7 to 15 who were found near a former church-run school in Cranbrook, British Columbia. The grim development follows two other reports of similar massive findings at such schools. Almost 1,000 unmarked graves were found in the previous findings. The Roman Catholic Church, which ran most of these residential schools, has yet to issue a formal apology. Angry people in Canada have destroyed or set on fire a number of churches. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said the discoveries were, quote, a shameful reminder of systemic racism, discrimination, and injustice that Indigenous people have faced. Dozens of Brazilian political figures have launched a fresh bid to impeach President Jair Bolsonaro amid allegations of corruption in COVID-19 vaccine acquisition and mishandling of the pandemic itself. A document signed by dozens of left-wing political parties, trade unions, and civic organizations, as well as a few former allies, were submitted to the Chamber of Deputies. It listed more than 20 accusations against Bolsonaro, including negligence in heading the response to COVID-19 that has killed over 515,000 in the world's second worst hit country in terms of deaths. The call for impeachment comes as a Senate commission investigating the government's handling of the pandemic has heard a number of witnesses testifying how Bolsonaro flouted experts' advice on containing the virus. Donald Rumsfeld, former Pentagon chief, dubbed the architect of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, has died at the age of 88. Rumsfeld worked in the Republican administrations of Presidents Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and George W. Bush. He oversaw the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks in 2001. 2 years later, the U.S. military invaded Iraq under his command. He came under fire after images surfaced of American troops abusing Iraqi prisoners in the Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad. He resigned as the Secretary of Defense in 2006. Political commentator Max Parry says former Pentagon chief Donald Trump has the blood of many people on his hands.
Well, I think like a lot of people, there's one less war criminal alive today with the news of Rumsfeld's death, and it really cannot be overstated that this is someone who shouldn't have been allowed to live as a free man in his final years. And it's just unfortunate that he, like the other key officials in the Bush administration, you know, Wolfowitz, Cheney, Powell, and of course Bush himself, all escaped justice and have never been brought up on charges of crimes against humanity, as we all know they should, despite the widespread evidence that Rumsfeld and the other neocons in the administration lied to go to war in Iraq in total violation of the UN Charter as an illegal war of aggression. So I did a quick survey of the Western media coverage, and even a few places like the Associated Press were trying to whitewash his legacy, and they eulogized him as, quote, a cunning leader who was undermined by the Iraq war, as if it was something that happened to him as opposed to war crimes committed against the Iraqi people, where as many as a million people died.
American comedian Bill Cosby has been freed from prison after a U.S. court overturned his conviction for drugging and sexually assaulting a woman 17 years ago. The 83-year-old was released following a Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling that he had been denied a fair trial. Cosby served more than 2 years of a 3-to-10-year sentence. His conviction was the first guilty verdict for sexual assault against a celebrity since the advent of the worldwide reckoning against sexual violence and abuse of power, dubbed the Me Too movement. Many, including the accusers of Cosby and supporters of the movement, expressed anger at his release. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fornaka Yupik village near the western coast of Alaska, the water is getting closer. The thick ground, once frozen solid, is thawing. The village preschool, its blue paint peeling, sits precariously on wooden stilts in spongy marsh between a river and a creek. Storms are growing stronger. At high tide these days, water rises under the building, sometimes keeping out the children aged 3 to 5. The shifting ground has warped the floor, making it hard to close the doors, and mold is growing. The article you're about to hear has been written by a New York Times journalist, Christopher Falavelle, and Kaylin Goodluck. The piece is titled, Dispossessed Again, Climate Change Hits Native Americans Especially Hard. Fornak, a Yupik village near the western coast of Alaska, the water is getting closer. The thick ground, once frozen solid, is thawing. The village preschool, its blue paint peeling, sits precariously on wooden stilts in spongy marsh between a river and a creek. Storms are growing stronger. At high tide these days, water rises under the building, sometimes keeping out the children aged 3 to 5. The shifting ground has warped the floor, making it hard to close the doors, and mold is growing. I love our building, said Eliza Tunichuk, one of the teachers. At the same time, I want to move from here. The village, where the median income is about $11,000 a year, sought help from the federal government to build a new school on dry land, one of dozens of buildings in Cherforak that must be relocated. But agency after agency offered variations on the same response. No. From Alaska to Florida, Native Americans are facing severe climate challenges, the newest threat in the history of Native Americans marked by centuries of distress and dislocation. While other communities struggle on a warming planet, Native American tribes are experiencing an environmental peril exacerbated by policies, first imposed by white settlers and later by the United States government, that forced them onto the country's least desirable lands. And now, climate change is quickly making that marginal land uninhabitable. The first Americans face the loss of home once again. In the Pacific Northwest, coastal erosion and storms are eating away at tribal land, forcing Native American communities to try to move inland. In the Southwest, severe drought means the Navajo Nation is running out of drinking water. At the edge of the Ozarks, heirloom crops are becoming harder to grow, threatening to disconnect the Cherokee from their heritage. Compounding the damage from its past decisions, the U.S. federal government has continued to neglect Native American communities, where substandard housing and infrastructure make it harder to cope with climate shocks. The federal government is also less likely to help Native communities recover from extreme weather or help protect them against future calamities, according to a New York Times review of government data. Interviewed with officials, members, and advisors at 15 federally recognized tribes portray a gathering climate crisis and a test of the country's renewed focus on racial equity and environmental justice. Many tribes have been working to meet the challenges posed by the changing climate, and they have expressed hope that their concerns would be addressed by President Joe Biden, who has committed to repairing the relationship with tribal nations and appointed Deb Haaland, the first indigenous cabinet secretary, to run the Interior Department. But Joe Biden has announced few specific policies or actions to directly reduce the climate risk already facing Native American communities. And Ms. Deb Haaland's office declined repeated requests for an interview. The stakes are very, very high, said Fawn Sharp, president of the National Congress of American Indians. She added, we're running out of time. mentioned, Lute Nation is a collection of about 135 homes on a narrow slice of land at the edge of the Olympic Peninsula that juts into the Pacific Ocean about 100 miles west of Seattle. As temperatures rise, the atmosphere holds more water, producing more frequent and intense storms. High winds now regularly knock out the electricity, while homes along the main street are vulnerable to flooding. The single road that connects the community to the outside world is often rendered impassable by water. The village is 10 to 15 feet above sea level, said Susan Devine, a project manager who is working with the Kilut. During major storms, those waves are bigger than you, she said. Hundreds of years ago, the reservation was a fishing village, among many locations used by the Kilut as they moved according to the demands of the weather. That changed in 1855, when a treaty stripped the tribe of most of its land. U.S. President at the time, Grover Cleveland, later issued an executive order confining the Kilut to a single square mile, and all of it exposed to flooding. No one chose to be in a seasonal fishing area year-round, Ms. Devine said. The resulting vulnerability has pushed the tribe to pursue a solution that few non-native towns in the United States have seriously considered, retreating to higher ground. Climate change has forced us to make the heart-wrenching decision to leave this village, Doug Woodruff, chairman of the Kilut Tribal Council, said in a December statement. Without a cohesive national and international strategy to address climate change, there is little we can do to combat these impacts. Through a spokeswoman, Doug Woodruff, and other members of the council declined repeated requests to be interviewed. In 2012, Congress gave the tribe permission to relocate inside the adjacent Olympic National Park. But without a tax base to pay for its move, the tribe sought federal money. Progress has been slow. The Kilut received about $50 million in grants to build a new school farther from the coast, but the total cost to relocate homes and the other facilities could be 2 to 3 times that much, according to Larry Burtness, who manages federal grant applications for the Kilut. 40 miles south, the Kinault tribe has been working on its own plan to retreat from Tahola, the reservation's main town, for almost a decade. Tucked between a driftwood-strewn beach and a coastal rainforest, Tahola is exposed to storms, flooding, and frequent power outages. That tribe has also struggled to get federal help. There's no single source of revenue at the state level or congressionally to undertake these kinds of projects, said Ms. Sharp, who was president of Kinault Nation until March. The U.S. federal government offers help to communities coping with the effects of climate change, but Native Americans have often been less able to access that help than other Americans. We're the most disproportionately impacted by climate, but we're the very least funded, said Anne-Marie Chischilly, executive director of the Institute for Tribal Environmental Professionals at Northern Arizona University. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is less likely to grant requests for aid from Native tribes recovering from disaster compared to non-Native communities, according to FEMA data. Native Americans are also less likely to have flood insurance, making it harder to rebuild. Of 574 federally recognized tribes, fewer than 50 participate in the National Flood Insurance Program, according to a review of FEMA data. That's partly because the federal government has completed flood maps for just one-third of federally recognized tribes, compared with the vast majority of counties. Flood maps can help the tribal leaders more precisely understand their flood risks and promote residents to purchase flood insurance. But insurance premiums can be prohibitively expensive for Native Americans. Individual households on Native American lands are also less likely to get federal help, girding for disasters. Of the 59,303 properties that have received FEMA grants since 1998 to prepare for disasters, just 48 were on tribal lands, according to Carlos Martin, a researcher at the Urban Institute. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, said it is committed to improving tribal access to its programs. Chair Fonak's efforts to relocate his preschool illustrate the current difficulties of dealing with the federal government. While the Federal Emergency Management Agency offers grants to cope with climate hazards, replacing the school wasn't an eligible expense, according to Max Neal, a senior program manager at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium who helped Chair Fonak search for federal aid. The Department of Housing and Urban Development has a program to pay for infrastructure on tribal lands, but the maximum amount available wasn't enough for a new school, and the agency wouldn't grant money until the village had found other ways to make up the difference. Replacing the preschool would only begin to address Cherfanak's troubles. Some 24 homes need to be relocated, potentially costing more than $10 million, according to Sean Baginski, an engineer working with the village. And Cherfanak is just one of more than 100 native villages in Alaska alone that are exposed to significant climate risks.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. It is my absolute honor and pleasure to be with you guys today. And of course, with my wonderful friend and sister, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's really an honor for me to be here.
So, Sister Razia, we've been talking about reproductive system health and hygiene for both men and women, and we have been discussing some herbal, natural, sometimes even off-the-counter remedies to help men boost their sperm health and count, to have healthier reproductive systems. So we talked about melon, watermelon, and melon. Melon is different from watermelon. It's like longer, and the color is like orangish.
I haven't seen watermelon in the West. No, I have seen like different kinds of melons, but not watermelon. Mm-hmm. No, this kharbuza that we have in Iran.
Right.
Maybe lately they have imported them. Another fruit that is really good for the male reproductive system is sweet pomegranate.
Sweet pomegranate.
Not sour pomegranate.
Right, interesting.
Pomegranate. Yeah, it actually increases the sperm amount and will make the child very beautiful. Yes, so this is another blessing from God. Another one is the olive, whether it's olive oil, whether the olive itself. So Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that olives actually increase the semen, the sperms. And specifically in the 3-month self-care period where man and the woman have to detox and everything. So in this 3 months, if you use melon, watermelon, olives, sweet pomegranate, they're really, really good. Another nutrient which is very good for a man is... fresh milk with honey.
Interesting.
Yes, it's really good food for empowering the sperm, enabling it to be more active and to have a good count.
There was a study shown that people, a group of people, put on a diet of honey and milk for a while, and the only deficiency they had was vitamin C. But don't do it. I mean, I can never drink honey and milk because I already have a problem. I have an underlying problem. But for a healthy body, honey and milk really provides everything.
Yeah, it's really because it also calcium is very, very, very good for in the sperm reproduction.
Mm-hmm, interesting.
And because there's plenty of calcium in milk, probably one of the reasons that, and also I think honey makes the absorption of this milk and the nutrients in milk so much easier. That's why it's
recommended.
And having it one or two glasses a day to have them in their program, in their daily nutrition is very good. Another very, very good fruit, as we've also, is very also very good for women, is quince. It's really, really, really good for puring the sperm, for refreshing it up, to have like to not have old sperms that have, you know, deficient sperms. And also it's very, very good for improving the nerves, the nervous system.
Of the baby?
Of the father.
Uh-huh.
Right.
It's important to have a father with a healthy nervous system.
Exactly.
It really is.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, besides having all the nutrition, you know, the good nutrients, you have to have a very good psychological,
Absolutely.
Being in a good psychological state. So if you have the best of the best fruits and vegetables in the world, but you're always tense and stressed, so you would have a lot of problems with your sperm. For quince, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that if prior, you know, in the very beginning of the day, you know, before having anything else, on an empty stomach, have a quince, since it purifies your semen, and it makes the face and countenance of your child very beautiful.
Beautiful, right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
right.
Gorgeous.
So
okay.
Very good.
All of these so far are Middle Eastern fruits.
And but these days, everything is exported and imported. So you don't have any problem.
But still, I know for a fact that Southeast Asian countries, unless you go to like really high-end malls, and even if they're imported, they're probably like festered with preservatives, and what's the other thing that you said, which also affects fertility?
Pesticides,
you know?
Yeah.
It defeats the objective. So what is a person who's living in the West or living
That's
in South America or Southeast Asia supposed to eat? Ginseng. Ginseng in Southeast Asian culture is literally the solution to everything, and increases libido, and it healthens the sperm. And ginger and garlic.
Exactly. We're gonna mention that.
Oh, thank you. Alhamdulillah. Gentlemen, you're saved. Worry not.
I don't know if at the time of the Prophet, they had the roman, the pomegranate, grown in Saudi Arabia.
They did.
Have you heard of gardens of pomegranate?
Yes.
I've heard of gardens of anab, but I haven't heard any gardens of pomegranate or of quince in Saudi Arabia. So
I know that they had rumman, they had pomegranate.
And I know that at that time they brought in, they imported a lot of like stuff from Sham,
Yemen,
Shamat, right?
And
these places.
We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
We're back here on Muslim Lady with my special guest, Sister Razia Shamali, where we're discussing the health and hygiene of male reproductive system.
Now let's go to some herbs that are very good for the men's, male's reproductive system. One of them is chicory.
Okay.
Yeah. Chicory, whether you use the fresh vegetable or you take the extract in terms of the extract of chicory, it's been mentioned in a hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that try to have chicory, as it increases the amount of semen. It increases your semen, and also it makes your child to be very beautiful. And also for those who want to have males, male children who want to have a baby boy, chicory is a very good herb to be used. Also, for those people who have a hot temper, chicory is very good for cooling down
up,
the
right.
system and to calm them. And it's especially it's very good to be used in springtime, as this is the time that it grows, and you can use the fresh chicory plant. And when it's not the time, you can use the dry leaves of chicory and crush them, and use one teaspoon of chicory in a hot glass of water.
Yep.
Add some honey and use like two small portions of this juice every single day.
Mm.
Right. Something else, another fruit which you can find in East and the West, it's pear. So pear, I'm sure you've heard that it's very good for making the baby very beautiful. It's very, very good for the male semen or the sperms. Also, in other religious sources, it's been mentioned to have local eggs, local organic eggs, right? Eggs are very, very good for
high
sperm
protein,
production,
yeah.
High in protein. Also, eggplant in fall time, as it increases the libido.
Mm.
And strengthens the semen. Also, in the book of Avicenna, in the traditional medicine that he has mentioned some points about strengthening the male reproductive system. He talks about certain nutrients for the males. One of which is sweet grapes, as it strengthens the semen. And when it's out of their time, raisins are really, really good. And also some other herbs that are highly recommended to be used by men is chives, which you can
find
plenty
everywhere
in the world.
Make sure to brush your teeth after you're done eating chives, though.
Also, thistles, mint.
Mint is good.
Mint is very good. Mint tea, whether you want to have, like, mojitos, cold or hot drinks, they're great in increasing the reproductive power of men. And instead of having the lettuce or the ordinary kind of salads that we are accustomed to these days, you go to the coffee shops, you go to restaurants, at homes, everywhere you have lettuce, try to replace it with these kinds of herbs.
Right, yeah. It's so
these are
easy.
Fabulous for the, you know, for
so
strengthening
the... So lettuce in itself is very, it has very good qualities. It's high in calcium,
but it's very cold
fiber,
in nature.
It's cold in nature, exactly.
And it's not good for the reproductive system
of men or women.
Yeah, so try to replace them with these fruits and vegetables and herbs. One more thing that is very highly recommended in the book of Avicenna is the seed of certain vegetables. For example, seed of carrots. Seed of carrot.
But carrots are cold. Carrots?
I don't think they're cold. Carrot seeds, celery seed.
Like, how are you supposed to eat this?
Let me tell
them?
You.
Okay.
Purslane seed, black radish seed, white radish seed,
right.
Celery seed, purslane seed, sesame seeds.
Definitely sesame seeds.
Right? The way you have to do it is that you have to take 100 gram of each of these seeds, clean them, not to have any stones. Grind them together, and every single day have one teaspoon hot water, and for 40 days have that.
Subhanallah.
It will help you with your
baby making machine.
Exactly. Besides these nuts, such as almond, pistachio, hazelnut, and walnuts, they're super, super good for empowering the sperm. It's especially good for men. And also, if you find them to be hot in nature, try to have
followed
a little bit of
chicory right.
afterwards.
Okay. To cool you off.
To cool you off, exactly.
Thank you so very much, Sister Razia, for this most informative, knowledgeable, and interesting discussion. I learned a lot, and I hope our listeners benefited from our discussion as well. To all the gentlemen out there, take care of yourselves to have
better lives, better wives, better children, and a better hereafter. Thank you for being with us on this episode of Muslim Lady. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return. La ilaha
the Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Most
Muslims around the world will never be safe until the issue of Islamophobia is taken seriously and tackled head-on, says Mohammad Kasber, writer, in an article titled Islamophobia, 4 years after Finsbury Park attack, Canada death show threat undiminished. Stay tuned for more. Ago, someone had rammed their van into worshippers as they left night prayers at Finsbury Park Mosque in North London, and one of the worshippers had been killed. This was a mosque, a community hub, a space of solace. Now the sense of serenity had been shattered by an act of hate. The days that followed saw a flurry of activity and chaos. The world's media camped outside the mosque. Security was heightened, official visits took place, and promises of change were made. 4 years on, we're still waiting for those promises to be fulfilled. The politicians and media may have moved on, but the community has not. Makram Ali, who was mowed down in the attack, is still dead. His children are still without a father, and those who knew him and prayed beside him still live in fear that an attack like this could take place again, and that their names will be the ones written in obituaries. The mosque has received endless calls from Muslim women in the area worried about being the victims of hate crimes. And we have had to put on workshops and therapy sessions to help with the trauma the people are experiencing. Lives as a community were changed forever on June 19, 2017. And we are still feeling the effect of that attack today. It is why we were pained and horrified to see such a similar attack take place in Canada earlier this month, where 4 members of the same family in London, Ontario, were killed because they were Muslims. Reading about this incident gave Muslims flashbacks to what took place outside the London mosque and the unimaginable terror and horror unleashed that day. Though these attacks took place hundreds of miles apart, the source of this hatred is the same, Islamophobia. Islamophobia is the darkest smog that people have allowed to descend on their societies. What was once exclusively the rhetoric of the far right on the fringes of society has now infiltrated the mainstream and has become the acceptable face of racism. The Islamophobic attacks that took place in Finsbury Park, Ontario, and Christchurch, to name a few, did not arise in a vacuum. They are the culmination of decades of institutional Islamophobic discourse and radicalized policies that have filtered down from the top to Western countries' streets. Islamophobia is not simply surviving, it is thriving. And people put Muslims at risk when they fail to acknowledge the pattern of hate locally and across borders. In the UK, there is a political class that still refuses to acknowledge Islamophobia and take it seriously, and a media that is complicit in spreading negative coverage of Muslims and demonizing them. From London to Al-Quds, from Christchurch to Oslo,
The impact of Islamophobia is clear for everyone to see, yet the response to its rise globally has been met with inaction, silence, and in some cases, celebration. Following the attacks in London, Ontario, the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau declared that Islamophobia has no place in his community. But despite this, Ontario's government blocked the motion condemning Islamophobia. Similarly, leaders of the Conservative Party in the UK reneged on their promise to carry out a truly independent inquiry on Islamophobia in the party, and the Prime Minister still refuses to apologize for several Islamophobic comments he has made. Let us be clear. Muslims will never be safe from another attack until the issue of Islamophobia is taken seriously and tackled head on. For Muslims at Finsbury Park Mosque, and for many Muslims across the world, another Islamophobic attack taking place is not a case of it, but when. Though these attacks are intended to cause terror and fear, they also draw out the best in people. From the courage of Imam Muhammad, who protected the attacker from the anger of those who had nearly just killed, to those who sent flowers and cards from across the world to the mosque and Makram's family, to the hundreds from the local community and beyond that gathered outside their mosque the day after the attack to show their solidarity. Christchurch and London, Ontario have their heroes and well-wishers too, and what these acts of solidarity show are that those who try to divide them have failed. We hope that Muslim communities around the world do not have to experience what people in London and Ontario did in order to come together to fight the scourge of Islamophobia. And we hope that governments around the world reflect the actions of their citizens who are calling out in one voice against this evil.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.